From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. Hal Ashby went from Utah farm boy to editor of some of the most innovative films of the 1960s, director of some epical films, films such as, well, let's see now, Shampoo and Being There. And the author of an amazing new book on Hal Ashby, Being Hal Ashby, is sitting right across me, Nick Dawson, and he's going to give us the last detail of the book. I'm sorry, you must hear that pun all the time. First of all, Nick, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Elvis.
And you were saying before we got started, the book has been a real passion project. You just threw yourself into it with no real place for it, but it was something you had to get done.
Right.
Did you have a favorite Ashby film at that point?
The weird thing is that I'd probably maybe only seen Being There at the time. The way into the book for me was the life rather than the work. And over the course of writing the book, I discovered that I'm a massive Hal Ashby fan. I love a lot of his films. Maybe two-thirds of his films, I think, are really superb. And the rest, well, there's different reasons why I don't love them quite so much.
They're probably the films he lost. I'm guessing 8 Million Ways to Die.
Yeah. I mean, that's the classic case of the Ashby film that was taken away from him. He had a lot of troubled production history, post-production histories on the films that he made in the 1980s, but this one was literally taken away from him before he stepped into the editing room and was, you know, the plan that he'd had to edit the film was scrapped and the film was reimagined by the studio, essentially.
And another editor. But as you quote from Jeff Bridges in the book, to take a film from Hal Ashby at the point where his greatest strength lies as an editor was completely insane.
Yeah. There was basically a strategy that producers and studios had developed to deal with Ashby in the 80s, which was we get him on board a project. This attracts actors because he was an actor's director and people loved working with him. But once we get into post-production, we take control. They were terrified of what he was going to do because he had developed this reputation, which was an unfairly received one, as somebody who was unstable and a drug addict loose cannon.
Before we get a little bit further into this, even for reading the book, it's kind of hard to get a sense of where the reputation of him being a huge cokehead came from. And you even talk about somebody who went to work with him to assist on one of the films who still went in and left the editing process thinking that he was a drug addict, even though there was no evidence of that as this woman was working with him.
Yeah. You can look back and try and sort of retrace the steps and work out where that reputation came from. One you could make a strong case for was the fact that in the mid to late 70s, he admitted in an interview with the New York Times about cocaine in Hollywood, that he had taken cocaine. And at the time, he'd taken it on Bound for Glory, which was his the film that he made about Woody Guthrie in 1976. And it had been a bad experience, and he'd basically learned from that experience. And, you know, he would take cocaine sporadically through his life, but it wasn't his drug of choice, and it wasn't a drug that he took with any regularity. He was a pothead, and that was what he did. He was, from his friends in the 50s through to the people that he worked with in the 80s, everybody says, you know, he pretty much had a joint in his hand whenever he could, and he was basically ended up having almost no effect on him, whereas everybody else would just, if they were trying to keep pace with him, would really struggle.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to the writer Nick Dawson about his great new book on the director Hal Ashby. The book is Being Hal Ashby, The Life of a Hollywood Rebel. What I found fascinating about him, too, is that, you know, if you look at the book Easy Riding, Raging Bulls, he's kind of depicted as sort of a passive guy. And he was a director of enormous passions. And one film that was a huge passion project for him that he kind of lost control of, not in terms of the editing, but the way the studio publicized it, was Harold and Maude, mm-hmm. which is a film that has really taken on, even like 5 years after its release, had taken on a whole other feeling. And it's weird because that film felt like it was the perfect film for that era, and yet it was dismissed pretty widely by the mainstream critical community at the time.
Yeah. It's a fascinating case of a movie that really came back because of the audience. You know, this was a film that people found. When it was released in 1971, Paramount, the distributor, were terrified of the concept of this film being a romance between a 20-year-old guy and an 8-year-old woman. So they pitched it as like this touching.
The younger guy was played by Bud Cord, and the older one was played by Ruth Gordon.
Exactly, yeah. And so they basically kind of tried to fudge that in their publicity. And so people went in thinking, oh, this is like a charming story about this friendship between this young guy and this old woman. And when, you know, they realized what the film was, that's not what they were prepared for. And the initial reception was very bad, but ended up having these incredible runs for like 2 years at a cinema and people seeing it like 350 times. And it really, it's the quintessential film that that people just found and latched onto. And it's funny because Bud Cort doesn't like the term cult film, but I think it is. It's kind of like the ultimate cult film in a way.
I think so too. And about that period, about 71, 72, is when he met Jack Nicholson, who fell in love with him and his work. And you point something out in the book that I only heard a little bit about, and I didn't know how much had gone into it. In 72, Ashby and Jack Nicholson and his then-girlfriend, Michelle Phillips, were going to do another adaptation of The Postman Only Rings Twice, which would have been a perfect timing for both Ashby and also for Nicholson being the right age to play the part.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the projects that was going to be their first film together, and that fell through basically because MGM, who were going to bankroll the movie, didn't like the idea of Michelle Phillips, who was actually Nicholson's girlfriend at the time, playing opposite him. They were kind of like, you know, this is a pop star. Why would we want a pop star in a movie? People won't get this. They won't like it. Is there going to be any chemistry? Can she act? And, you know, in retrospect, it's a great shame because I think it would have been a really fascinating movie. And, you know, Ashby ended up being involved with the Bob Rafelson production of you know, what ultimately became the remake of Postman Always Rings Twice.
Which is 10 years later.
Which was 10 years later. And it's one of the many, many projects, including a lot of them with Nicholson, that never quite happened. And that was one of the really fascinating things for me. Writing the book was discovering all these projects that just are so tantalizing because they, you know, a lot of them sort of got very, very close to being made, but didn't in the end. I mean, there was The Hawkline Monster, there was Henderson, The Rain King, you know, both with Nicholson.
And Nicholson would have been perfect for Henderson, The Rain King.
Right. After The Last Detail, he was always really looking to involve Nicholson in projects that he was working on. So, I mean, he even considered him for Bound for Glory, for Coming Home.
In the articles I read about him just growing up, he was always talking about the work and about the obsession with editing. But the fact that all over the course of his life, he basically kind of built tribes around himself. He was trying to make these families, and he could never keep the family together. But in the meantime, he did keep these kind of groups of people who both worked with and lived with him, too.
Yeah. You know, he had five wives. And even though he never quite managed to sort of find that relationship, romantic relationship, if you like, people were really, like, his ex-girlfriends were almost all of them, you know, ex-girlfriends and ex-wives would speak fondly of him and think back with great affection on him. But it was always the work. I mean, the work was really the thing that consumed him. I think he referred to his films as his children, you know, and that's really indicative of the way that he looked at things. The irony is, of course, it was the kind of child that suited him in a way.
He spent 2 years with Then You Walk Away.
Exactly. His daughter Lee, who was born when he was 18, you know, he never had any contact with her at all.
And even as you detail in the book, that when he did marry and there were children involved, he was always really bad with the kids.
He always went in with very good intentions. He had a romantic idea of himself as a family man or as a rescuer. I mean, his third wife, he essentially rescued from being a high-class call girl, and his fourth wife, he met when she was pregnant with somebody else's baby and married her and became the father to that child and then also helped her adopt another child. He liked to put himself in positions where he was helping, where he was a part of a family unit, but the problem was that he could never sustain that. The thing that truly drove him and that you know, his real passion was for the work, and that always caught up with him and you know, things ended badly in all those family setups. You know, tragically, in the case of his last marriage, his stepson, who he'd sort of given a job to through Chuck Barris, who was a friend of his, you know, he ended up dying of an overdose. And, you know, you can make a case that Ashby having assumed the role of stepfather, just drifted away back into the work and didn't follow through on his responsibilities.
We're talking about the amazing breadth of work of the director, Hal Ashby, which goes from The Landlord to Being There, from Bound for Glory to Harold and Maude. The author of the great new book on that director, Being Hal Ashby, is Nick Dawson. We're talking about the book. As we talk about this, I kind of find myself thinking that he really did find a family at one point when he attached himself through work and then a kind of a brotherhood, a working brotherhood with Norman Jewison.
Yeah.
Who was the closest thing to real family he ever had. And in reading the book, I almost kind of felt like the dissolution of that relationship had a really big psychological impact on him. We should say he edited films for Norman Jewison.
Right.
The Russians Are Coming and In the Heat of the Knife, which won the Oscar, which he didn't show up to get.
Yeah. Jewison really helped him so much. I mean, Ashby spent eight years as an apprentice editor because somebody told him that if he wanted to become a director, being an editor first was a really good idea. And you know, he didn't take the direct route. He took a very slow and arduous approach. And when he became an editor, a chief editor, he almost immediately started working for Jewison. And Jewison really showed him the ropes, brought him up through the ranks, and was kind of like an older brother figure to him. And it was, you know, through him that he made his first movie, The Landlord, which Jewison produced, which Jewison was originally going to direct. And Ashby, from that point, really tried to pay forward the favor that Jewison had given him by giving a chance to young and up-and-coming writers and directors and you know, people throughout the film industry to give them their chance just the way that he had been given his chance.
And it seems to me in the book, and from reading the book, that the real love affair of his life was Norman Jewison. I mean, they really did love each other, and there certainly were battles that they had, but they really loved each other, and they loved the work, too. And that was the kind of the perfect relationship for him.
Yeah.
And in trying to find that, as you talked about in the book, even at the end of his life, there were people he was trying to get set into the business in the way that Jewison did for him. When he didn't have that relationship, in some ways, the rest of his life kind of mostly personally, suffered.
Yeah. I mean, Jewison was a great sort of counterbalance to him. Jewison presented a sort of rebellious front, but he always knew how to deal with the studios. He would be tough when he needed to be and would be an appeaser, you know, when he needed to be also. And the problem with Ashby was that when they parted company, he didn't have that. And there's an incident when they were filming The Landlord. I think they were behind schedule and you know, things were a little bit bumpy. You know, Ashby was having trouble with the studio about finishing the film in time and on budget. Jewison was trying to sort of take the studio's line on this a little bit, and Ashby said to him, you know, but you said to, you know, screw the studios, you know, be rebellious, you know. And Jewison was like, yeah, but you've got to calm down. And that's what he really failed to have. I mean, they had not only a great friendship and a great understanding, but the partnership that they had really set a perfect balance. And when Ashby went into Hollywood in the 70s, he was really very anti-establishment, very anti-authoritarian. And that kind of worked okay for him during the 70s when that was what people did. That was the way that directors were. The directors were people with a lot of power. But in the 80s, everything changed. And that was really the biggest factor in the decline of his career, I would say, was his inability to play the game and to be political and to understand when to be strong and when to fold.
We'll take a break. I'm talking to the author of the great new book on Hal Ashby, Being Hal Ashby, Nick Dawson. We'll take a break. It's The Treatment. You can hear the show at kcrw.com. More to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. I'm talking to Nick Dawson, who wrote this great new book on Hal Ashby, Being Hal Ashby. You said you came to Hal Ashby through being there, but I wonder, after having done all this research and written a book, what your feelings were about the film by that point, because you'd also aged a few years, too.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a film that, along with Harold and Maude, that people most associate with him and love him for the most in a way. And I think it's possibly the most sophisticated of his films, which is ironic in a way, because there were concerns at the time when the film was being made that this was kind of like a one-joke movie.
As you mentioned, the book, Peter Sellers was concerned about that.
Yeah. As with many of his films, in a way, he brings comedy out of non-comic situations and turns comic situations, gives them gravity. And so I think that's why it works so well, is that, you know, as with all of his films, it's an incredibly human story. And I feel like if you'd had a director who didn't have that sense of humanity, it would really have just been that one joke. It's a film that really has a continuing relevance to American politics.
Because for me, I kind of felt like his first film, in a way, was his greatest film, The Landlord, because it could potentially have been a one-joke film. Mm-hmm. And it has a real depth of feeling in the comedy mm-hmm. that set the tone for everything he did. And I always find myself as being, especially when it was revived not too long ago, a couple of years ago, shocked at the kind of comic sophistication in it.
Yeah. People always ask me what my favorite Ashby film is, and The Landlord, just because I feel like it's a real lost classic. It's just such a wonderful, wonderful movie, and it has a very special place in my heart, just because I kind of tend to champion the underdog. I mean, that's partly why I told Ashby's story, is that he's somebody who's really got lost in the shuffle, in a way, in the telling of Hollywood history. He's somebody who, you know, people know his films, but they don't necessarily know him. But The Landlord it's an incredible film. And for a debut movie, the assurance and the skill, I mean, you know, there's parts of it that are really very experimental in their style. The editing is very, very sophisticated and complex. He tackles race, which is always difficult, you know, particularly the time.
And for studio films in general, which tend to be very kind of on the nose about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. There's a line in it where Lee Grant, who plays the protagonist's mother, she says, oh, well, you know, we all went to see Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. You know, that was kind of the standard set by the studios for, like, films about race. It's like Sidney Poitier, the angelic African-American. And this really goes way beyond the fold of that template and brings this neighborhood, which is ironically now incredibly gentrified, Park Slope, to life. And these people are characters. They're not just types, you know.
And the funny thing about that movie is that all the things that he had done in his life led up to that. I mean, again, if he looked at making movies, being part of a tribe, he built the tribe there, right down to everybody living in Park Slope, so they would get that sense of being there and not just being interlopers.
Yeah.
And that all the things that he did, I think, led to that movie.
Yeah. He had people sort of camped out there. He hired locals instead of, you know, sort of security guards at the time it was a dangerous situation to be in, but he really integrated the film community and the actual community into one thing. You know, people were cooking for the cast and the crew. People gave up their apartments so that the cast and the crew could be there in the daytime. He really fostered a sense of community on every film and tried to bring people together, you know, with this common cause. I mean, he was really among the most democratic of directors, not in a political sense, but he would listen to suggestions from everybody. You know, be it a grip or his actor or the screenwriter. And this fostered a sense of community and of people feeling that they were trusted. You know, with actors, he would never give them notes. He wouldn't point them in a certain direction. He would just say, you know, let's go again. Even if it wasn't working, they would feel like he trusted them to get it right.
One of the things I found really profoundly touching in the book is the enormous amount of affection the actors felt about working with him and the way they would give him chances to do things. And I just think about the things Andy Garcia said about stuff they were trying out for 8 Million Ways to Die, that when those clips were even used in the movie, they were used so badly, they throw the movie out of whack.
That movie is a great example, because they essentially began the movie without a script, which was actually very similar to Coming Home, which ironically won Best Screenplay at the Oscars. He was really fearless. It was a very, very difficult situation. He had already a difficult relationship with the studio on that movie, and he was just told he basically had to begin, and he had the actors writing the script themselves, basically with him in a trailer, and Robert Towne was rewriting at the same time. And again, like, everybody was really pulling together in this tough situation, and he had a plan for what the movie was going to be, and he had complete confidence in the actor's ability and his ability in his crew's ability to do it. But you know, as we talked about before, that the problem was that he needed to be at the helm to sort of pull everything together during post-production to have the vision that he had created assembled correctly, you know, for the finished film.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to the writer Nick Dawson about his great new book on Hal Ashby, Being Hal Ashby. You can hear the show at kcrw.com. It's so funny that he thought the best way to become a director was to be an editor, which is probably the worst way to get into it. On the other hand, you make a very good case for the fact that it was a perfect way for him to get into it because he lived with films the way editors live with films.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing that basically subverted the rest of his personal life made him the complete film director.
Yeah. I mean, he completely immersed himself in film really once he got started, and he had a real knack for editing, be it, you know, just knowing where a take was in a room full of cans of film. He would just know where a take is. You know, he was brought up by Robert Swink, who was William Wyler's editor and George Stevens' editor. He started off from this base of, like, you know, these great directors and as you know, a classical Hollywood perspective, and so he started really with the rules, if you like. And from there on, he was able to sort of take those and tweak them and subvert them. And I think it made him the director that he was. And he just had an incredible passion for the work. I mean, Norma Jewison, you know, talked to me about the fact that, you know, he would never go home at night. They were both married, and Jewison would kind of say, you know, it's 9 o'clock. We better get back, or, you know, I'm sure dinner's on the table and wives are going to be waiting. And Ashby was like, okay, let's just try. If we change this, I'm sure we can make it better. And, you know, in the late 60s, he would just sleep on the editing room floor. I mean, he just would not leave. And when he was cutting the Thomas Crown Affair, I mean, he essentially just camped out there for like 6 months while he cut it.
And he and Pablo Ferro really changed filmmaking in the cutting of that film.
Yeah, I mean, the multiple sequences in Thomas Crown Affair was a great example of the way that he would work with people. And, you know, Pablo Ferro was this editor who would do title sequences and stuff like that. And they had to cut some footage out of the movie because it was this one, the polo sequence in Thomas Crown Affair was too long. And Jewison said, right, we need to lose something. And Pablo Ferro said, well, maybe I can have the images simultaneous. And Ashby was like, well, try it. Let's see what happens. And that was exactly the kind of spirit that he would bring to his whole approach to filmmaking with Scott. Let's try it.
And the amazing thing about that, putting that in the body of the film rather than having being a title sequence, is it changed filmmaking forever.
Yeah. But Pablo is also just like a great unsung hero. And he was incredibly helpful with the book as well. I mean, he gave me this great outtake of Ashby and Peter Sellers on the set of Being There, just basically goofing around for doing this little promo film for the exhibitors.
I'm reminded of something which I didn't know before I read the book, which is that Peter Sellers didn't like the outtakey kind of stuff on the end credits.
Yeah.
And I don't disagree with him, actually. You know?
No, I don't either. I think it's a tough thing for me to take too much of a position on, because I think the outtakes at the end really give us this great insight into his process, if you like. It underlines the genius of his performance because it shows what he had to kind of struggle with. This was a hilarious movie, and he was just deadpanning the whole time, except for really this one isolated incident. And he was really very upset, you know, as he wrote in a very anguished telegram to Ashby. He said, it breaks the spell. And, you know, it's true, but I think he was also worried that it lost him the Oscar, which I don't think is necessarily true, because he was nominated for Best Actor that year and lost out.
It's the truth. I'm talking to Nick Dawson, whose great new book is Being Hal Ashby, The Life of a Hollywood Rebel. I just keep thinking about his partnership with Norman Jewison.
Yeah.
That it really was sort of these two guys who completed each other, right down to Jewison telling Ashby how he had to deport himself to get through an airport, not constantly be pulled through customs every time he walked through.
That's a great example of like the influence that Jewison had on him, because you know, he would always say, you know, dress for immigration. Just when you're going through customs and immigration, just, you know, don't look like you've just smoked a joint. Don't smell like you've just smoked a joint. As you say, when they had parted company, and Ashby was doing location scouting for The Last Detail up in Canada, and he came back into the country, he had some weed on him, and he got arrested, and Columbia got very upset. They managed to bury the story. But straight after that, shaved his beard. You know, he trimmed his beard, I should say. And he tried to make an effort to look more like the part. And he never went back to having a beard that long or looking quite as wild, kind of this crazy hippie guy. At the same time, he never was able to completely jettison that. He never was clean shaven, and he still dressed however he wanted to.
He really was the perfect guy for the 70s and the worst guy for the sort of the corporatization of the film business in the 80s.
Exactly.
And came up against that as soon as the 80s started, really. I mean, when he tried to set up his own company and that didn't work out, and then the fights he had. And he had really lost two films between Looking to Get Out and 8 Million Ways to Die. Yeah. And the cusp of the 80s was really, in a lot of ways, his greatest creative success with Coming Home, a film that he built in the editing. And I remember, and I mentioned to you when I met you, reading some old piece of American film, he talked about wanting to make the film from those office films available, starting with Coming Home, so that new editors could just try to build their own versions of these films.
Right. I think he donated all of the material to UCLA. Because he had this crazy idea, which kind of remains crazy but still ingenious, of allowing people to go out there and make their own versions of the film from, like, all of the footage. And it's just an amazing idea. I mean, what better way to understand the editing process of a film that you know and love, to go back and do it yourself and to see what choices were made and to see what works and what doesn't and why somebody did this and why that's about their personality and how you could make it about yours. And it's kind of amazing.
I think one of the things that's really great about your book is that now, thanks to all this attention, the complete version, Hal Ashby's edit of Looking to Get Out, a kind of a lost Hal Ashby film,
mm-hmm. yeah.
is coming out on DVD.
It's really, really exciting. This was a movie that Ashby delivered to the studio in 1982, and they looked at it and went, it's too long, need to take 15 minutes out of it. And the released version of the film, which, you know, ran for 1 week and then was pulled, everybody really has forgotten about, is a really inferior version of his vision of the film. But in writing the book, I came across people who said, you know, there's another version out there. And so I kind of discovered that UCLA Film Archive had a copy, without them even knowing it, of Ashby's version of the film. When I told John Voight about this, and he, you know, he's the star of the film and he co-wrote the film also, he was incredibly excited. And 2 years or so since, you know, we first had that conversation about the existence of this film, it's now coming out on DVD thanks to the efforts of John and of Warner Brothers, who are releasing it. It's just really so exciting to see, like, basically a new Hal Ashby film sort of out in the world.
If only because it's the film debut of one of the world's biggest stars nowadays.
Right. Angelina Jolie, it plays John Voight's daughter. It's good casting in the film. and it's actually pretty good. You know, maybe that's going to help the film reach an even bigger audience. Who knows?
Well, we're out of time. Nick, thanks so much for doing this. It was worth this 6-year investment
for
the book.
Thank you.
The really great book by Nick Dawson is Being Hal Ashby, Life of a Hollywood Rebel. Our recording engineer at Argo Networks in New York is Paul Ruess. Bob Carlson is the editor, Gemma Dempsey the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I need some editing. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.